Hey, before we get started here, if you are a repeat listener, can you do me a quick favor and rate and review the show right now? We're really making a push to get great guests on the show, and your reviews help us attract the very best guests. So if you could do that, I would really appreciate it. Now let's dive into the show.
You find a property, you have people, long-term tenants, they've been there for a long time. That's a good thing because it shows stability, but then they get comfortable as well.
Hey guys, David Robinson here. Welcome to the Lead Sponsor Podcast. I'm really excited about our episode today. I've got Ivan Vian with me today. Ivan, how you doing? I appreciate you coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, David. I'm excited. Look forward to spending some time here with you.
So Ivan is the co-founder and chief operating officer over at Anthem Capital. He's a retired lieutenant colonel from the Air Force. Thank you for your service, by the way, 20 years. And he's passionate about the operational side of the business and growing Anthem's portfolio. He has a vision of growing the portfolio to over 300 communities, which would allow them to donate $2.5 million in profits to charity by 2030. And to date, Anthem has acquired 19 different projects with a total acquisition value of roughly $232 million. So, Ivan, I'm really excited to get into your journey and hear about your story and how you navigated the transition from the military world into real estate investing. But before we do, let's talk about your business today. How is your business structured? What are you guys focused on? Maybe just give us a high-level overview of what Anthem looks like today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Anthem Capital is comprised of two individuals, Tariq Sattar, co-founder of Anthem Capital, and myself. We started Anthem in 2016, and at that time it was two guys buying apartments, just wanted to get a few apartments and do good and make some good money as well. But we quickly found out we love this business and love the people aspect of this business. So today's structure is focused on building out a team. And the way we do that is we identify key partners or team members that are co-located with the assets that we're buying, because I just feel it's so important to have local boots on the ground representation, especially in light of the current fiscal conditions we're experiencing today. Someone needs to be there to crack the whip to make sure these properties are performing well. And so that's what we have. We're focused in Kansas City. So we have a great team up in Kansas City that we're co-GPing with. Also in Dallas, we have a property in Dallas now. We sold everything else this year. And Salt Lake City.
For Salt Lake City, my neck of the woods.
Your neck of the woods. Oh, wow. A lot of good snow up there. And
that's right.
I've been to the slopes lately. But Salt Lake City, so the GPs are not co-located, but we have an in-house construction manager who is there every day, overseeing the rehab, overseeing the asset, and acting as an interface between Anthem and the property management company.
Love it. So let's dive into just a couple aspects of that. So you mentioned that you've sold off everything except for what you currently hold in Kansas City, Dallas, and Salt Lake. Have you bought in any other locations other than those three with the assets that you have sold?
Yes, absolutely. When we started this business, I live in Oklahoma City.
Okay.
We bought in our backyard in secondary tertiary markets, Norman, Oklahoma, a little town called Chickasha of 35,000 people.
Okay.
We bought in Oklahoma. We bought in Little Rock, North Little Rock, and Arizona and Orlando. We're just exiting Orlando this week as well.
Love it.
Definitely a variety of markets that I've been in and learn how to operate successfully each in these different markets, because they all have their own particular nuances.
And can you add a little bit more context to, you mentioned this concept of co-GPing with someone that's boots on the ground in the local market. Give us a description of what that means. Like, what roles does the co-GP that's local in the market play? What do you play when you are working on a deal together?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we co-GP, there's high level things that need to
be looked at and overseen, and more low level things, micro things that need to be looked at and overseen. So the micro things would be this: someone is working with a contractor or in-house construction team to determine, develop, and execute an interior rehab plan. They need to walk those units with a contractor and specifically identify what things need to be rehabbed and to what level and degree, what paint colors to pick, what type of knobs to use, what's the overall objective of infusing capital into the interior and exterior components of the building. So they're consistently shopping the comps and seeing what the competition is doing. And then they're working directly with the property management company, not only in person, but through KPI calls and KPI meetings. And they're there, they have their thumb to the pulse of the property, and they are the belly button, if you will, the gatekeeper. Mm-hmm. Or that's where the buck stops, is with this person or team or one or two individuals. In this case, Kansas City, we have in Kansas City a team of two. And so they're handling the finer details of what is going on. And then we have, for example, I'm kind of getting in the weeds here, but we have a report we've created called a lease trade out report. The lease trade out report identifies every single renewal and every single lease that is written. And we compare the rent that was determined. We compare that to the performer rent, the market rent. And we also look at another category, upgraded rent, because the market may be higher than what our performer rent is. And if we upgrade it, it may be even higher than that, or the other direction, it could be lower. So they're like there physically and also putting their eyes on the leases. We have them do that, where in the beginning, we want to make sure that everything's in order. They're putting their eyes on every single lease and making sure whatever is on paper is actually in the system. So that's like down to the weeds kind of level. Taking a step back though, Anthem, me as the main asset manager, oversee the main operator for Anthem, I'm there as well, but I'm not physically at the property walking with the contractor. I'm not physically putting my eyes on the leases, but I'm still reviewing the lease trade out report and looking at a higher level and an aggregate level of what the trends are. And I use my track record, my experience after doing this for quite a few times now and doing this for a while. I know what questions to ask. I know what things need to be done. And I am guiding and leading the team on the ground to make sure we execute what we need to execute to ultimately meet or exceed the projected returns that we communicated to our investors.
Yeah, I love that. Thanks for going into a little bit of detail about that. You are mainly on the operational side and the asset management side, but if you can, and I'm okay going to the weeds again on this, describe on the front end acquisition, how the relationship works with your co-GP local and with Anthem being remote. Who's sourcing the deal? Is Anthem sourcing the deal? Is the co-GP sourcing the deal and then bringing Anthem into it to assist with, you know, the acquisition side? Maybe describe that for us.
Yeah, absolutely. So these relationships over time happen organically. And so, for example, Kansas City, we developed a relationship before going into looking at deals in Kansas City. And the relationship, this couple just happened to live in Kansas City. We started doing market research and decided that, hey, we like Kansas City and we're very favorable with that market. And so through our relationships, through the brokerages, and then through their relationships as well, we kind of started sourcing deals together. But with them being there local to the market, and by the way, they own rental property already, they understand the good areas, the bad areas, and the nuances of any particular submarket within Kansas City. But to answer your question, the deals may come to us directly from a broker because we've developed relationships with all of these submarkets we're in, regardless of who we are working with in that submarket, or it may come through the GPs we're working with through their relationship with brokers. There are times where we get a call from a broker, we underwrite the deal, everything looks great. Hey, let's partner with someone in the submarket and we bring the deal to them and see if they're interested. But then when we're going through the acquisition phase, it's essentially a team effort at that point. Given that they're co-located to Kansas City, in this example, they would go shop the comps again. They would go put their eyes on their property. They would go sit in the parking lot late at night and see what the feel, the vibe is. Hey, is this a You know, is there a lot of crime here? And then they would also, they would understand from a more local micro standpoint, what is the economic opportunity at hand? What is the, you know, they'll know of a building that is going up or a job course center going up near an apartment. They'll know more than we would know. And that's the value that they bring in the acquisition phase. Tariq Sattar is our main underwriter and main transactional representative in Anthem. So he's more involved in this process than I am. Where I come in, though, is I look at the operational viability of the plan. Like, I think through, is this logistically executable? How many people do we need to actually rehab this property? Like, is the timeline make sense? Like, you're asking me to do a lot in a short period of time. Like, no,
you're the check and balance to
check and balance. Yeah,
all the excitement on the front end of the deal, right?
Yeah. It's kind of funny in this business. It's like, if a deal is not going as well as you thought, the executor says, well, you underwrite that deal poorly. And then the underwriter says, well, you're executing that deal poorly. So true. It goes hand in hand, but correct. I'm looking at, you know, the execution, how well can we execute that plan, and what are the risks of that plan, and how we're going to mitigate those risks overall.
Yeah. So you mentioned Kansas City, Dallas, Texas, Salt Lake City. If you could just describe for us briefly, what are you focused on today? I know in the past you've invested in tertiary markets and probably some C-class stuff. Like, what are you focused on today? What is Anthem looking for in a deal?
Right. Cut my teeth on a lot of 1970 product, flat roof, boiler chiller. And for me, those days are done. I don't want any more of those deals. I want a nice class B plus and an A class area, bringing in a stronger property manager. I shouldn't say stronger, but you can bring in a property manager company with maybe a little higher budget, create some more longevity, a little more experience. So that's pitch
mainly roof, mainly B class value add type stuff.
B class value add in these major markets that you already indicated.
Yeah.
Now listen, like, I'm not gonna, if there's an opportunity that pops up in Oklahoma City and Little Rock again, because I've been there, or a market similar to that, I'm not going to turn it down. But the back of my mind is, again, from an execution standpoint, how well can we execute this? What is the labor pool at hand? Like, for example, in Salt Lake City, here's a lesson learned. We underwrote the deal and we said it's going to be $8,000 a door to rehab before they started raising the interest rates. We closed on October of 21. We get into Salt Lake City and we're realizing interiors, it's in the double digits to rehab. And two, another lesson learned is when you buy an apartment in a market that's growing, and maybe you don't have market share representation, not established there just yet, you're the new kid on the block, and you're going out and finding contractors to work on your property. In these growing markets, all the major contractors are sucking up the labor pool, all the talent. And thereby, you have limited supply, high demand, those labor rates continue to grow. And affecting your overall rehab budget. And also due to COVID, if you remember, the labor pool participation rate went way down. Like, people took a time out with COVID, opened back up, and no one wanted to come back to work. And so there's even fewer people to work on these properties. And so that affected the rehab budget. And so, yeah, it's good to go in markets with good population growth, good rent growth, strong job growth. But then you have to realistically understand what type of impact that's going to have on your ability to execute when it comes to finding talent and labor to work on these properties. In a growing markets, there's a lot of competition for talent. And that was a lesson learned. However, the solution that I came up with after having to let a couple of contractors go, I was able to acquire some Ukrainian refugees due to the war and some local Ukrainians come to my property, live on site, and work. And these guys were workhorses and they worked their tails off. And it was amazing to watch this develop. One, they were not being pulled to another property. Another thing, when you're buying, you know, when you're working with a contractor, they may have 2-3 jobs going on. I don't like that. I only want them working on my job. You're only dating me right now. Okay. Two, they're on site and they get up, you know, they start at 7 and they finish at 7, right? And so what I was able to effectively do is my productivity doubled on what I can produce on interiors, as well as do exterior rehabs and repairs and paint. And my cost decreased 15% or so on a relative basis to that market. And so that's why I realized, everyone's been talking about in-house vertical integration of construction management. And that's where everything just totally went to the next level for Anthem. Now that's what we have. We have in-house vertically integrated construction teams, and we're doing the same thing in Kansas City, Ukrainian refugees living there, and developed great relationships. And they're just amazing people. They're just incredible. And they do so well, and they go above and beyond for us.
I ask a question about that? I'm just curious about the process. Was it a natural thing that you just sort of stumbled upon, or was it intentional? And regardless of actually how it came about, I'm curious about the process that you went through.
Yeah, great question. This is a personal situation. Obviously, if you can find a way to get people to leave you on your property, wherever they come from, whoever they are, that's the takeaway here, right? But personally, I had a friend who's Ukrainian that I've established many years ago. And he saw me on Facebook buying apartments, you know? And he's like, hey, I can help you. And it was interesting. He came to Salt Lake City in the beginning and didn't quite go as well on the due diligence side of things. So we went with a couple other groups. It wasn't until like, dude, I'm in a bind. I need some help. He's like, I got you. So he sent someone out. We did all the due diligence and felt better about it. And it was off to the races. Mm. And he was the one bringing people to the property and creating a team. And he's the belly button that now I work with for my Kansas City deals. His name is Alex. So it was just a friendship that allowed me to have this opportunity. But then I realized, like, on the back, like, there's so many invoices and all these little moving parts and all these nuts and bolts. So I built a back office, you know, and I have people managing the whole draw process now. And I'm people managing, reconciling the books, making sure the vendors get paid, make sure everything reconciles. So naturally, I just created this whole vertically integrated construction company as a result. And that's how we're going to go out in 2023 and execute these future opportunities coming our way.
And do you think utilizing this network of Ukrainian labor is scalable for you? Obviously, it translated in from Salt Lake City to also Kansas City. Does it translate to Texas? Is his network sufficient where if you wanted to tap into that, you could?
100%. Hmm. First of all, the leader of Salt Lake City lives in San Diego. The leader in Kansas City lives in Atlanta. They're mobile. Hmm. And they go to project to project to project. And my bench is deep. I mean, we can get as many as we can handle.
Well, and I'm assuming they're hungry. Work to and probably coming from the situation that they're in, they're grateful to have an opportunity to come and be working on something putting their effort into something.
It's just so refreshing. It really is, like, the attitude of what they carry, and you know, they're having fun. They're on your property and they're bringing life to your property, new energy. And they're grateful to be here, to have an opportunity. And they did this work in their own country. And so it's in their blood, right? Mm-hmm. And they're very proud of what they bring. They really are. And that makes me proud. That makes me happy to have someone take pride in their work.
Yeah.
No matter what work it is.
Well, thanks for letting me dive into that a little bit. That's very interesting and unique.
Hey, real quick, before we get back to the show, if you and I haven't connected yet, head on over to canovocapital.com and subscribe to my investor network. From there, my team will be in touch to schedule a brief call. I'd love to connect with you and learn more about your investing goals, what you're working on, what you're looking to do in the future, and also let you know about some of the projects we're working on over at Canovo Capital. So go down into the show notes right now and click on the link, or just head on over to canovocapital.com and subscribe to my network there. And I look forward to connecting with you. Let's get back to the show.
Let's back up a little bit. We're jumping around, which I like, because I like getting into some of the details of your business and how you're structured and how you think. At the same time, I do want to go back and discuss your journey. You know, you spent 20 years in the Air Force and made a transition into the real estate world. Let's talk about sort of how that transition started to take place and how you actually navigated it.
Yeah, great question. It's an interesting story, an inspiring story, and I love to tell it. I always wanted to be in business. I knew in the back of my mind there is something in me that said that you're going to be in business someday. And in the military, we traveled to different bases. So in 2007, I relocated from Rapid City, South Dakota, to Abilene, Texas. And at the time, my house wasn't ready to move in, so I was staying with my mother-in-law. And on the street she was at, she said, "Hey, there's this lady down the street. I know you've been wanting to get into real estate maybe or get into business, but there's this lady down the street that unfortunately she's going through a divorce and she really needs to sell her house." And I said, "Okay." So I literally just walked down the street, knocked on her door and introduced myself. Said, "Hey, I heard that you're looking to sell your house. You know, what can we do?" And she said, "I need to sell." And I said, "How much?" She said, $33,000. And I said, "Sold." And that was it. I didn't even do a comp study. I didn't do like rent comp study. I didn't even know what that stuff was. I just said, "I'll buy your house." And thankfully, the bank I was working with gave me a loan for my personal residence I was about to close on and this rental property. I put 10% down at the time. It only needed about $4,000 or $5,000. I had a little bit of money saved up. It rented for eight something, and I was making about $300 a month on passive income. I was like, "Oh my God, there's something to this real estate game." And that's when the light bulbs went on. I was like, I gotta buy me more real estate. So, but fast forward, I move into that house I just told you about, and my wife's pregnant with our first child, right? And so, anyhow, the baby comes, we go to the hospital, but we had to go to the hospital so quick, we didn't grab the bag that you have ready to go, right? She said, "Honey, you know, can you go back home and get the bag?" I said, "Fine, I'll go." "Yeah, no problem," you know? So I go back home. Well, next to my house with this boarded up abandoned home, that was just sitting there. And I was like staring at it, like, "What's going on with that house? What's going on with that house?" And so I go back home and get to the front door. I was like, "Oh yeah, that house." And I was like, "I wonder what's going on with this house." And I was looking at my wife.
Meanwhile, your wife's in labor at the hospital.
Well, we just had my baby, you know.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha.
He's in the, you know, he's in the prenatal section.
Whatever. Gotcha. Okay. Right,
so, but
okay.
Still, you know, like I'm leaving my wife hanging there. So I look at my watch. It's like, I got a few minutes. I get on the tax roll. I see where this guy lives. I say, "I'm going to go to his house. I got to buy me more real estate," right? So I go to his house. I knock on his door. And dude, it was like this big burly man, no shirt on, hairy chest. He's like, "What do you want?" It's like, "Sir, I think you own the house next to me. I'm interested about it." He's like, "You want to buy it?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Follow me." Literally, I go up these stairs, this darkened, like narrow stairway up to his attic, and he sits me at this table, and there's like one little light, this kind of swinging like this, and like barely any light coming down. And he showed me like on some papers, like the loan. It was like, I remember it was like $77,250. I still remember, right? And he's like, "That's what I owe on it. If you want to buy it, that's what you can buy it for." I said, "Done." Right? I did good on the first one. I'll probably do good on this one. Why? I didn't do good. I bought that house. I didn't do a CMA because I didn't know what that was. I didn't do analysis of how much it's going to, you know, I did a little rehab analysis, but what I did was I over rehabbed that property, took it to the studs, built it back up, and immediately went $60,000 in debt and took me out. And I learned real quick about mentorship. I learned about, of course, comp study. I learned about rehab. I learned about all the things you need to learn about in real estate. And a lot of the stuff that I learned there today is what I use in my apartment business Well, what I learned back then is what I use in my apartment business today.
Yeah. Love that. So how did things progress from there? You know, that's back in 2007. You really went headlong and started Anthem in 2016, roughly.
Yeah.
Talk to us about sort of that transition period from, hey, you're still in the military. You're looking to exit. You probably have some thoughts about what you want to do after you exit. What did that transition period look like?
Yeah. So again, I got mentorship once I realized I needed it. And in that mentorship program, I learned about apartments. First day was single family, second day was apartments. I was like, oh my God, that's what I need to be doing. But meanwhile, like I'm going through this financial crisis. I'm a captain in the Air Force. I got my first baby. I don't have any money. And I didn't have the belief thinking I could do that. I put that idea on hold, right? But I said, but I want to be in real estate. And then one day I was flying in my airplane. I was a B-1 bomber pilot in the Air Force. I remember West Texas, and coming home on a training mission. I was at 24,000 feet. I was like, looking left. I was like, oh my God, I did it. I did my dream. You know, I became a pilot. I'm here. I was like, what next? You know, I was like, oh yeah, that apartment thing. I want to do apartments full time. So that idea started brewing. But again, I didn't have the belief. I put it away. So I decided to change my career, to go from pursuing all there is to you can do in the military. I'm kind of the guy, I always want to go as far as you can. So the idea of being a general and all those things, or going to school, extra school and all that stuff. I put that aside, I said, no, I'm going to do what I can to have a good career, still do my service, but pursue real estate. So I got an opportunity to move to Oklahoma City in 2013. Best thing I ever did. It was a reserve job. I still got to fly. I still got all the benefits and pay, but I had time. So I hit the ground running after learning all my lessons from 2018 to 2013. Basically, I wasn't doing much real estate then. I bought a couple more properties. I started over, saved up money. I hit the ground running in 2013 and started buying single family properties in Oklahoma City. I quickly ran out of money. A broker said, get your license. So I went and got my license, and my role was to represent only investors. The first client was my business partner today, Tariq Sitar. He and I just hit it off. And back then, you can buy these rental properties for $35,000 a pop. I don't know where you can do that anymore in America today, but we were doing Oklahoma City, 35 to 50, and we're getting 2% deals. It was amazing. And that was an incredible opportunity. That was my pivotal moment. Was I sold 99 houses in 2 years as an investor realtor, and I served. I took care of my clients. And as a result, I formed a really good relationship with Tariq. And one day we're underwriting a single family property. It was the beginning of the year in January, February, I remember in 2016, and underwriting, like, we can't get these 2% deals to work anymore. What do we do? I said, hey, there's this guy that I know in Dallas. His name is Brad Sumrock. He's having this 2-day event teaching you about apartments. Let's go check it out. He agreed. Went down to Dallas in March of 2016. Sat through that 2-day event, and he looked at me. I looked at him at the end of that event, and he said, let's do this. You know, let's go for apartments. And that's when Anthem Capital was started, and we just hit the ground running. The same thing that I've always been doing haphazardly at times, but now I have mentorship. And by the way, I have a powerhouse of a partner, a doctor degree in finance, worked in corporate America in restructuring business and working in failing companies, learning and knowing how to make them healthy again. And that was a great educational opportunity for me. And I just sat there, and I remember every night in a study learning about all these things that they don't teach you in the Air Force. Plus, I was a pilot, you know? I knew how to use Excel to do other things in the military, but not to underwrite a deal. And Brad Sumrock, of course, had all the training materials for me to learn. And I quickly learned. I became a sponge, and I just hit the ground running. 9 months into that, we bought our first 3-property portfolio, 214 units, 2 in Norman and 1 in Chickasha. And it was just off to the races after that. To date, Anthem Capital, in 6 years' time, has done 3,000 doors, 19 properties. This week, at the time of this recording, we'll have sold a 14th property with an average annualized return around 27%. It's been a great experience, and I'm looking forward to the next go out of here in the new season, as I am now a full-time apartment investor. I just retired from the Air Force about a year ago.
You got it. All right. Love it. Thanks for walking us through that.
Absolutely.
I want to shift gears here a little bit, and let's dive into this recent acquisition. And then I want to talk about also a deal that you just recently exited, because I think it'll give two different perspectives. The one that you exited, which we'll get to here in a moment, was bought and sold probably at the perfect time. Whereas you recently just acquired Hunter's Glen in Kansas City, a 253 unit deal. If you can, let's start at the top. How was this deal sourced and who's involved?
Absolutely. Well, the way it was sourced is we bought another property just prior to Hunter's Glen in February of this year called Holmeswood Apartments. And that broker brought us to Hunter's Glen. And we put our eyes on Hunter's Glen. Like, it was love at first sight. I don't know. That sounds kind of cheesy, but it really was, man. This property, first of all, you looked at it, brand new roof, siding, balconies, HVAC. We learned brand new plumbing, brand new electrical, 1970s product. Same owner for 30 years. They treated this property like their own baby. The only thing it needs is interior improvements, cosmetic interior improvements. Not to be judgmental here, but their taste isn't that good. So we're like,
yeah.
This thing needs some pop, man. Right. And so we saw the opportunity there. And we're going through the financial challenges we're experiencing. It's hard to find relatively good financing today. In the rising interest rate environment, bridge debt is kind of blowing up, not there anymore. Fannie Freddie leverage points don't work for us.
And just to give some context, we're recording here end of December, but you acquired this in what, roughly
August,
July?
August 30th of August, 2022.
Okay. End
so
of August.
We're underwriting this deal probably around May, you know, April, May is when we first put eyes on it with the intent to buy it. But we knew, like, we just sniffed it. We knew this thing's an opportunity, right? Like, it's so clean. And the cost basis, we bought Holmeswood for 80 something. This one was for 90 something a door, if I do my math right here. But we knew stuff was trading over 100 a door just from a cost basis. We're like, that's a great sign. Plus the great submarket. Plus, again, we have local representation of the couple I told you about that is operating Holmeswood. So we have instant intel and data of how to underwrite the deal. And what happened is we were best and final, and we came, it was as it always is, neck and neck with another buyer's group. They were able to source debt from a local bank and to underwrite that deal. Meanwhile, we are still sourcing with some bridge lenders we were working with because we had a good relationship underwriting it that way with the cap and all those things, right? Well, the deal was awarded to us, and then we got it, and now we're going through the underwriting process, and then our bridge debt blew up. We went back to the broker, let him know. He said, hey, the other person that didn't win the deal sourced a local bank for financing at a fixed rate. And I remember we were there on due diligence when the financing plan blew up. My partner called an Uber, grabbed his briefcase, and went straight to the bank. And he came back about 2 hours later. He's like, I got us a loan, 4.99% fixed.
Wow.
It starts out recourse, trails down to non-recourse once you hit certain debt cover thresholds. So we found a great loan product with a local bank. And local banks are so much easier to work with, because you see the committee right there. You're dealing with the people that make the decisions. And so the acquisition part with the bank, they'll have their own challenges and nuances, but from a relative basis, it was pretty darn easy. And again, that just goes back to relationships. So we had a relationship with this broker. We did well on the first one. We stayed in contact with him, and he brought us this lender who he has a relationship with, because he's always working with them to source other deals in Kansas City market. And then we were able to quickly execute on that. You know, like, when you have that bird in the hand, take it. Don't continue to shop. We knew the interest rates going to continue to rise. There's no way you can get a 4.99%, right? And so that's how that evolved.
And as far as sourcing this deal, you mentioned that it was a broker relationship that bought it to you. You had done a previous deal with them. I assume it was fully marketed because you said it came down to best and final, correct?
It was fully marketed, did come down to best and final. And other people were just didn't see the rent growth opportunity that we were seeing, I'm assuming. And again, it comes down to relationship, because we closed so easily with that first property. And I mean, for the newer listeners here, you got to perform well with that broker, and you got to see them as a long-term relationship, and your ability to execute and perform it, how you treat them, how you talk to them, how you handle it. I mean, we went out for cigars and drinks, you know, we've done dinners and we've done all of those things. Like, how you go about that from a relational standpoint makes all the difference. And so of course they're going to want to work with you again if you can do all those things and still execute, perform well. And that's how we're able to kind of have the leg up with this particular deal and transaction. Let's fast forward. It's December. We bought in August. We're going through the re-tenanting phase. People there, you know, living with low rents for 30 years. You know, there is some balance to how aggressive you want to be given the seasonality of the leasing world we live in. But long story short, we're darn near hitting performer rents as is. As is. We don't have to go through the full renovation rehab that we originally underwrote to because of the strong upside and strong organic rent growth in that market.
Have there been any hiccups or challenges that you faced on this deal outside of the financing? You described that well, but as far as the operation, the takeover, has there been any challenges that you faced that we could learn from?
What I would say is when you find a property, you have people, long-term tenants, they've been there for a long time. That's a good thing because it shows stability, right? But then they get comfortable as well. And the previous owner was more focused on occupancy. Like, it was 99% physical when we bought it. And you know, the sweet spot is around 95. And so plus they weren't doing like electronic payments. And so we're trying to implement that. And that is a learning curve that the tenant population has to go through, learning how to set up, you know, direct payment, which this is 2022, soon to be 2023. This is the world we live in today, and how you create efficiency. So that is one little challenge that we're going through. See, the rehab phase, we're just kicking that off, and because we want to test the market a little bit, but we went through those challenges on the previous deal in Kansas City, setting up the process, working with the contractor, and things like that. And we got our costs down, and so we know how to manage those better for this deal. But so far, it has been relatively smooth, quite honestly.
And you mentioned, have you considered holding off completely on the rehab, considering that you're where we're at in this sort of uncharted territory and uncertain waters? Have you considered, hey, let's pause rehab, let's see where we can take these rents naturally? Yeah. And then consider, you know, what our options are in the future.
Yeah, 100%. So this is December. And for me, I always, you know, do my budgets end of November, beginning of December for 2020, the next year for 2023. So we just had this discussion here the other day. And so, yeah. And especially given inflation, how much it costs in materials and labor, you look at the ROI of that on your rent bump and you weigh, does it really make sense to infuse all this capital in the interiors when you're only realizing this relatively, you know, smaller rent bump? And so we learned that from the first property, and we're applying to a lighter renovation versus doing like backsplash, granite countertop, new cabinets, new hardware, maybe just paint and flooring, right? And new appliances. And actually what we're doing is this, we're trying to capture all the renewals up to market. And the way tenants think is, well, yeah, I will pay rent, I'll do that for you, but what are you going to do for me? And what we're doing is just replacing appliances to better refresher looking appliances, which is an easy swap out. And so the ROI of a $1,200 appliance set, you know, $1,000 appliance set of the entire set is a lot, obviously smaller cost than a full reno, but you're still realizing darn near close, if not above, in some cases, pro forma rent, depending on the unit type, studio one or two beds and three beds.
Yeah.
And we found that a studio one beds, you can hit pro forma as is. Two beds, you need to do some type of upgrade, but still hit pro forma. And so, yeah, that's how we're able to save all of our capital. And we have a very strong capital budget, and it'll allow us to weather the storm in the event if the tide continues to go out. And if you,
sure,
you watch the trend lines, when anytime there's a rise in interest rates, then they drop. But parallel to that, unemployment increases. And you're seeing how that has an impact on your rent growth. Although we're conservative and on our overall assumptions we use on percent rent growth year over year, it could still have an impact. And so if there are any capital needs, which again, we're well stacked, there's not going to be the case, but it's always good to have a little bit extra capital in times like this.
Yeah. And in the past, you started in 2016, you've sold off, you've bought a total of 19 assets. You've sold off 14 of those. So clearly your business model is like many others, which has been, you know, get in, acquire the property, add value, sell. Has the business strategy and hold period changed for this acquisition than what you've done in the past?
Nothing's ever really changed in how we've done our underwriting. Always a 5-year period window that we use. On average, it's been a 3.5-year hold period. What we tell our investors, it may, you know, we're underwriting to 5 years, but if we can project to hit the return numbers we promised you sooner than that, we're going to go to market and exit. And so nothing's really changed. And for me, from underwriting standpoint, I know there are people that use 10-year models and all these things, but like, how can you really predict beyond year 5, let alone beyond year 2 or 3? I've been doing this for 6 years, and the market has shifted about every 12 to 18 months, something different going on. You know, 12 to 18 months, you know, we had COVID, and now we have the interest rate hike environment we're in. And from a debt standpoint, the debt product, the debt game always changes. You know, during COVID, it was bridge loan, right? Now we're talking about fixed debt, or assumption to get deals done that way. Before COVID, it was the Fannie Freddie world, doing a lot of small balance loans, Freddie Mac small balance loan, 80% levered. You know, and it was a rising tide, and these deals just simply worked. But we learned about the yield maintenance, the step down prepay, and a lot of people gave up a lot of return because they didn't manage that well enough, right? And so my point is, you know, the debt market always changes, seem like 12 to 18 months from now. So those are some thoughts on that.
Yeah. The strategy is still,
still the we're same.
Underwriting to 5 years.
Yeah, the strategy is still the same, you know, and the concept's still the same. And we're looking at the data, we're looking at CoStar, we're learning from the actual real world boots on the ground intel, and we're making our own assumptions in our rent growth, economic vacancy year over year, what that number is going to be, what a reversion cap. In today's market, we're going to have more spread though. Like in Dallas, maybe it was about a 5 basis point spread year over year. Now we're probably want to book in a 10, just to give you a little more pat in a primary market. Depending on what kind of asset class it is, though, how much more spread you want to have. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. We don't underwrite to a cash out refi, especially in today's market. Like, you're going to have the debt cover to be able to, no, there's no cash out. It's like maybe cash to the deal to do a cash out refi. So we don't underwrite that. And then, you know, the viability of that, there's not certainty in that. So, and we don't underwrite to taxes. Of course, that's everyone's own personal situation. So all the returns we provide is pre-tax. But again, nothing has ever changed. It's just maybe the pads have changed, but the idea is you still put in pads and underwrite the deal from that standpoint.
I've noticed that as investors sort of mature, their businesses mature over time. Many of those who started out buying C-class, you know, deep value add deals in tertiary markets, you know, they have a few exits that helps them to really spur their business forward. They start to look for a little bit better quality asset, B-class and more larger markets. And then it seems like once there's been enough exits, it's not uncommon to have operators shift their mindset from, hey, we're looking for the next deal that we can turn in 3 years, to go finding legacy assets that they can go that are newer construction, you know, class A type product that they can hold for a longer period of time. Is that ever in the back of your mind, that strategy? It seems like not always, but it's fairly common to see operators go through that progression as they invest.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of that's driven by your equity expectations and what type of equity you're raising. And when you get into more of the Wall Street money, private equity money, they like those type of legacy assets. So now that we have a track record and we have a relationship with private equity companies, family offices, et cetera, yes, absolutely. We're looking at that type of product. And there's value add class A deals out there, right? In these markets, because the market continues to grow and newer products coming online. So yes, absolutely. There is that play that we are also considering and walking through.
Got it. Well, look, Ivan, this has been a great conversation. I want to be respectful of your time and start winding down here, but I got a few final questions for you that I'd love to just sort of get your knee-jerk gut reaction to. The first one is my favorite because everybody tells me they don't have a crystal ball, but if you had a crystal ball, what would you predict we see in the market over the next 12 months, roughly?
What do I predict if I had a crystal ball? Well, I think this is in the ball. What I'm about to say is that we're all talking about this. There was a lot of bridge debt that went down during COVID. And you're hearing the horror stories of they don't have the debt cover to do a cash out refi, or they're getting raked over the coals on the interest rate hike and they have to get out. They're distressed. And their lenders require them to escrow a rate cap in the tune of maybe $100,000 a month, $1.2 million a year. Like, they have to get out and quickly as the rates continue to rise. So you're going to see a lot of those deals hit the market. There already are, and there's rumblings of it, right? And that's therein lies the opportunity that we're all patiently waiting on the sidelines for. And so you're going to see a lot of people jump in at that point when those deals hit the market.
If you were to start your business from scratch today, what would you do?
I would team up quicker. I would build the team quicker. It was just Tariq and I for a while. Now we have a back office. We have a team. I have a full-time marketing officer. I would not hold back. I would have done more deals, you know? And I would have focused on my investor relations platform quicker. You know, the question is now, how can you create the best experience for investor beginning to end? Experience, right? How do you handle that? And so I would have built that quicker as well. You know, but in the beginning, you're bootstrapping everything. You're the marketing guy. You're this guy. You're that guy. You're trying to figure it out. Like, oh, yeah. Like, you know, like that's how you do lease trade out reports, you know. So I can, you know, but that's what I would do again is I'd focus more on the investor relations platform sooner and a team.
What has been the most challenging part of growing your business to the point that it's at today?
As a leader, you know, as a founder, like you're sourcing deals and sourcing equity, building broker relationships, building equity relationships, and you have your existing deals you need to manage and not take your eye off that ball, right? And so here you are trying to grow, but you can't grow unless what you have is growing and performing at the same time. And people get the mistake, they're always chasing the deal, but my mentality is, the way you find the next deal is take care of the one you got today. But there is that rub that happens, the tension of being pulled, finding the next deal, building the team, grow, and still trying to execute on what you have. So for me, that looks like I have to hop in a plane, and I have to. I get to. It's an opportunity to go to Salt Lake City, Kansas City, Dallas, all these different markets. On the way to the airport, I'm talking equity, you know, I'm talking investors, you know, and then I get there and like, maybe I meet up with the broker and go look at a property real quick. And then I go do asset management stuff, right? You know, but it's, you know, it takes energy, but same time, I love it. I love what I get to do.
Yeah. Is there a particular strategy or tactic that you're executing on right now in your business that's going really well that we could all learn from?
Yeah, strategy or tactic, right? That you can learn from. You know, this lease trade out report that I told you about, that it is very granular I didn't used to look at that level. I just asked the rent, property management company, what are the rent rates you're using right now? And I just put them on the KPI and that was that. But now I'm actually validating whether or not they're executing on the rent rates that they told me that they're doing. And that is a little bit handholding, a little bit micromanaging. I'm not there at, when they're writing the lease. I do give a little more guide, a smaller window of what they could do on setting those rent rates. But that is, that's where this whole thing's driven from. You got to have that rent growth. And so we develop our own tool, our own spreadsheet that allow us to look at things at a very micro level. And we also figured out how to automate that, which is pretty cool.
What's the cadence for that type of review or dialogue? Is it once a month? Is it biweekly? Is it weekly? What does that look like?
Yeah.
Quarterly?
Every week. And so I have a back team office that's creating this lease trade out report. And it's very critical. For example, I'm making sure that there's a connection between the construction team and the management team. The construction team may say they have 5 units rent ready. The manager team only says 2. So they're only advertising 2 units. And these 2 units are not in the 5 that the construction manager company said they have available. So there's a disconnect, right? And so that is part of the process and making sure that whatever the construction team sees, the property manager sees, and the rent rates are accurately reflected in that availability report in the system. At the end of the day, that's what they're going to market with. And that's what people see when that number gets syndicated across the different ILSs and in listing services like apartments.com. And so for me, that has been a game changer for us and how we're able to move the needle better, more efficiently. And cadence, weekly KPI calls, especially in the first year of acquisition, hands down, until the property stabilized, we're finished with everything. There's so many moving parts, weekly KPI calls. However, I like to keep communication all within about that hour's time. Mm-hmm. 30 minutes to an hour, depending on what we need to discuss that day. We bring on the construction team lead, bring on the lead asset manager, supporting asset managers. And of course, the property management company is there, at least the regional. Sometimes they bring on the local manager, depending on their viewpoint on that. And we're all there having a KPI meeting. I develop my own KPI board that looks at, like, honestly, like 50 to 90 different data points, depending on what's going on with the property. And I make sure everyone's synced up and the machine is moving in unison to where it needs to go. And if then is there any roadblocks, anything going on? We address it there on the call. A roadblock may be there's 99 work orders, 1 maintenance guy only, and we have all these make readies to rehab. So what we have done is we've, in Salt Lake City, we had this scenario where we had 75 work orders, 1 maintenance guy. Again, it's hard to find labor, right? One maintenance guy. So what we did is we took on the make readies, vertically integrated the construction management team, and let that one guy focus on work orders. My work orders went from 75 down to 7 in about a month and a half. What do you think my retention did? What do you think about my Google reviews and all of that did as a result? And what do you think about my production? I now have rent-ready product that's not bottlenecking of units available to put online because my construction management team is spitting them out, knocking them out. And that to me was a game changer as well.
If there's one position in your company today outside of you and your partner, Tariq, what position is most critical to the success of your business today?
That's a great question. If there's one position, you know, man, the operational stuff that I'm sharing, like that's in the background, you know, but in the forefront, really what we're focused on, the one position is investor relations. I have a full-time chief marketing officer under him as a director of, investor relations, and we're focusing on developing those relationships at a deep level. And that's the key to this business. Take care of your investors. And everything's centered around that ethos, because you're taking care of the property. Ultimately, at the end of the day, you're taking care of the investor because you're growing their asset, their livelihood in that deal. And so I take that very seriously, and we don't always get it right. And, you know, they're going to make mistakes, but my attitude is that. And so that is the most important role the operational stuff, like, you know, of course, that's what you do. It's what you're expected to do. It's like, it's not like, you know, just because you do that doesn't mean that you're any better or whatever. Like, that's the baseline. It's how well do you take care of investors, how you can differentiate yourself in this marketplace.
That's a great way to end the show. Ivan, this has been a great conversation. I appreciate you going into some detail about how your business is structured today, what you guys are focused on, and also backing up a little bit and telling us about your journey into the space, starting with that little property that you bought for, I think, $33,000 with 10% down when you first moved to Texas, all the way today where you've acquired 19 projects, valued acquisition value of $232 million and growing. I appreciate you coming on and sharing your insight and your knowledge. What's the best way for our listeners to connect with you and learn more about what you have going on?
Absolutely. Thank you, David. It's been a pleasure. Yeah, come find us on Facebook, Anthem Capital Facebook page. Like our page. You'll stay up to date and continue to be informed of what we're doing and where we're going.
Awesome. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. So if you've enjoyed the conversation with Ivan today, go down in the show notes, click on that link, and connect with Ivan and his team. And also, don't forget to subscribe, like, comment, share everywhere that you see this podcast or listen to this podcast or watch it on YouTube. Go down, like, share, comment, subscribe, and we look forward to talking with you again soon. Thanks, Ivan. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, before you go, if you and I haven't connected yet, please head on over to KonovoCapital.com. You can join our investor network or download our free passive investor's guide to multifamily syndications. Either way, I'd love to connect with you personally. Also, I just want to thank you for listening to the show and providing feedback and reviews. If you haven't already, please, please, please take a second and leave us a rating and written review. This helps us to be found by new listeners and helps us attract great guests in the future. Thanks again for listening to the show, and I hope you have a great day.